Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's July 10th, 2022, and welcome to episode 257 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and printers. I'm Paul Hagstrom, near Boston. I am joined by two retro computing enthusiasts today, the first of whom on my screen is Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing great. The weather's great. My mic is working. I'm feeling good.
Excellent. Also joining us is Carrington Vanston from Toronto. How are you?
I'm looking good. So I got that going for me. Not so right. Much with the microphone. But hey, it's a podcast. Isn't it more important that I look good?
I think
absolutely.
Exactly.
Video killed the radio star.
Yeah, we eventually got... nobody knows how, but we eventually got Carrington's mic working. We directed nice thoughts at it, and Carrington turned it off and on a couple times. Failed to upgrade the firmware a couple times. So, yeah, it's been actually a while since we've done this. I think it's actually been like a month. And the one we recorded a month ago isn't even on the feed yet. So welcome back, everyone. Thanks for coming. So we've been following this format of like looking back at the year that's sort of related to the episode number. So 1957 is the year that corresponds to episode 257. And among the things that happened in 1957 is that IBM marketed the first dot matrix printer. So we thought, all right. Printers. We can talk about dot matrix printers. That sound good?
Sounds great.
Perfect.
Excellent. Does anyone want to start?
I might as well start because I think Earl is going to have a ton to say because he's the printer guy in my mind. But I too will mention Epson, which I'm sure he's going to, in that my favorite printer, which is a weird thing to say because for the most part I've hated printers. Always. Printers are just terrible. They're made bad. They don't want to print, which is like the thing I wish they would do. I have struggled with printers for 200 years, it feels like. But I did have a favorite printer. When I was young, I had an Epson Spectrum LX80, which was just a typical dot matrix printer, but it was kind of sloped down in the front and it looked like a Fiero. It's like a streamlined, cool printer. Mm. Like it printed faster because of that sloped front.
I'm sure.
Beautiful, beautiful printer. I loved it. I had it for a long time. I loved the look of it. It gave me very little problems. And then eventually, not knowing it would be the only printer I would ever like, I probably chucked it in the garbage foolishly and moved on to troublesome inkjets and troublesome laser printers. And it's been downhill ever since. But back in the 80s, my Epson LX80 was chef's kiss, was a beautiful, wonderful printer that I loved. And I still miss kind of the sound of the dot matrix. If you're old enough, it's a nostalgic sound. If you're young enough, it's just awful. But it's a sound I like. And I right away, as soon as I moved away from an impact printer, from a dot matrix, like I immediately realized how often, especially at work, I had to print multi-part things. And so an impact mattered with like NCR forms, and suddenly everything was moving to laser printers and inkjets. I was like, well, but how do I do this? Oh, just print everything twice. But I'm like, but this is not really, and it was big old hassle. So, and that's what I think about printers, big old hassle. There's my baby shown on screen.
I like it.
My beautiful, beautiful. Well, that looks yellowed. It kind of was yellow when you got it. It was a weird beige, but streamlined front, three buttons, tractor feed, gorgeous.
That's interesting. That's the Epson printer I had. I think it was FX80, and that was just much more like you know, basic Epson box.
Which would be slower. This was streamlined, baby.
That's right.
Stick a printer in a wind tunnel and just go.
Excellent.
I loved it. Loved it, loved it, loved it. If I got a printer again today that was a dot matrix, I would seek out one of those. I have only fond memories. So, Earl, now tell us everything about Epson.
Yeah.
Well, I promise not to blather on, but I did work for Epson in the day when they were at the top of the heap on the dot matrix printer hierarchy.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure they had you to thank for that.
Exactly.
Absolutely. It was totally me.
Not a coincidence.
Even though I never actually worked in the printer support division, I'm sure I was the one responsible for their market share. But I loved Epson printers and still do. I would say that LX line was definitely among the more sleek of the Epson printers, because I remember like the MX80 and the FX80 being really boxy kind of beasts. Mm-hmm. One thing that was fun was one time my coworker said, "Hey, we've got an old TX80 in the closet. You want to see it?" It was a predecessor to the MX. I was like, "Sure." They opened up the closet. It was this horrendous metallic beast that would take like two or three people. I'm exaggerating, but it was just really clunky. Whereas the MX had that more, you know, plastic kind of look to it and didn't require a forklift.
So those initials, MX, LX, XX, whatever, do they stand for anything? Or is it like a car thing? It doesn't really mean anything? Like,
I never heard any backstory on where they came from. So don't know. Don't think so. I think it's exactly like what you're describing. Just somebody came up with some letters and numbers and thought, this sounds great. I think the 80 came from the 80 columns.
Oh, yeah, that
would
sense.
Be my guess.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. But
maybe they were afraid it was going to bomb, and so they took M80 and they inserted something else.
Just put an X there, just in case.
And it was a, if I recall correctly, it was a 9-pin. Is that what they were called?
That's right.
And so
it was a 9-pin printhead.
And then later, at one point, we got an Apple, like, letter quality. It's a phrase people used to bandy around, and it was like 24 pins or something. Look at this. And it just, in the attempt to make things look as good as a daisy wheel printer, which I always coveted daisy wheels, but is what it is. But
there was a set of Epson printers, the LQ series 24 pin printhead. I don't know what it was. I never really cared that much.
Too many pins.
I guess so. And, you know, they made pretty documents, but nowhere near as pretty as laser printers, which were just about to take over the world. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that even the cost of the dot matrix printers was enough to make it worthwhile to share them. And at first we had weird sharing approaches, like a 25-pin AB switch box, which was a terrible thing to do when everything was powered on, because basically, you know, you were disconnecting and reconnecting with power hot on the system. So don't do that. Later on, we figured out how to share them with a network like Novell stuff, but that was starting to get to be kind of silly.
That's a good point. I think my first sharing of things probably was printers versus sharing a drive. Mm-hmm. Or I think now that you say that, probably the first devices I ever actually networked were printers, like over Apple Talk or something like that, whereas here's one printer being used by three computers before shared drives, before anything. I really hadn't thought of that before.
And there were even little boxes that came out later that could do things like auto switching, or you could walk up and press the button, but they were solid state. They weren't like a physical switch that you would share the printers with. And they were worth it because, you know, you're talking like several hundred dollars and 80s dollars to get one of those printers. So if you had a couple people in a single office, they weren't going to be printing all the time. Why not? Mm-hmm. Why not share it? I just remember we had dozens of Epson printers at the aerospace company that I work for. And I was thinking about it this morning. I can't remember a single time of having to send one of the Epsons out for repair, which is just amazing. I mean, we'd have to occasionally repair the IBM PCs or repair the monitors that we got or whatever. But I don't remember ever having to send an Epson out for service. So I guess that's why they had the price tag they did.
Yeah, they're our like, Epsons, you know, at work, we had a work where we did printing for postal stuff, so like literally tens of millions of labels a year, all done on dot matrix printers on Epson ones that were networked, and also eventually rips and raster things for pre-press and press things. And like the one thing we never fixed was printers. It was just a thing. It would sit there in the corner just chugging stuff out. And every once in a while you replace a ribbon and that's it. And it would just last for like, 8 years of continuous printing.
Which is weird because it seems like they would be under a lot of like actual physical stress.
Yeah. And shaking.
They're mechanical
devices.
They
would shake the little desks they were on when they're printing. Yeah. They put on these little tables and they would like do the little shimmy as they printed 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm. You brought up a really interesting point though about the noisy.
I did indeed. It was great.
The noisy.
Oh, so let's cut back to that, shall we, Paul?
So,
and I still miss kind of the sound of the dot matrix. If you're old enough, it's a nostalgic sound. If you're young enough, it's just awful. But
the magic of radio. So I was also thinking this morning about how stinking noisy offices used to be. Because you'd walk in the morning, you'd turn on your IBM PC or AT or whatever, and the fan in that thing would spin up to, a million RPM. You'd be like starting to raise your voice to talk over it. And then you'd start printing something on the dot matrix printers. And just the amount of sound in the offices.
Why is there a donkey in that printer?
Good old days. Good old days. So noisy. By comparison, offices these days, the noise you hear is people. Noise you hear isn't the equipment.
When I got back into retro computing, I remember picking up a Mac SE, and the first time I turned it on, because I had a Mac SE back in the day, and I remember being this little silent box, and wow, that fan was loud. The fan and the hard drive, everything. I was like, is this how this really sounded? Is this what this is going to sound like? Oh, I'm changing that. But probably there was a long period where if you made enough, you were in a silent office, because you just sat there smoking your cigar or whatever as a big business person, and then there'd be like a typing pool and stuff, and everybody clanging away on things there in the noise, but you go in your silent office and have your 16 martini lunches. So there's that differentiator.
And not everybody had a computer. I mean, I know this is hard for people. Right. It's hard for people these days to even comprehend, but the upper echelon that you're talking about, very often they didn't have a computer. I remember when some of the first computers started rolling into their office, and they, would pick the PC support person who drew the short straw and had to go train the executive on how to use this newfangled PC. And that was always fun. One of the executives I was training would consistently hold the mouse upside down. And it'd be like, why is the arrow thing not going the direction that I point?
Blinding
you.
Oh, I guess I can be balls. Like, yeah.
Super diplomatic. It's like, well, I find that it tracks a little better if you use it in this orientation. You turn around, it's like, oh, wow, look at that. It actually works. But
more diplomatic than I would have been.
Aircraft company? I mean, that's the way you control airplanes that way, right?
Exactly.
So you just
pitch
pretend.
And yaw. That's true.
That's the confusion.
So,
did you guys ever have things? Oh, Tony, Curtis is talking about this kind of thing in the comments. We had boxes that we would put our printers inside that were specifically designed to muffle sound. So when we had these line of label
printers,
and a lid could open up top and the paper would feed in and go out, but it would just basically a thing like you'd put nowadays a blender inside just to keep it quiet.
Yep. We had these big plexiglass boxes that the printers went in with a little slot in the top where the paper could come out. And it's like the printer was a hostage or something like that. As it's doing the printing, but it's a lot.
You do excellent printer
more
sounds.
More palatable. There's way too much time in front of them, I think.
Yeah.
What about you, Paul? Yeah. Tell us your experience with the glory of the dot matrix.
Well, yeah, I mean, so I, for a long time I had, had one of these, the boxy Epson ones. And I never did know what the distinction was between those, FXLX, MX ones. I mean, like, I do think they had slightly different, capacities to do graphics or whatever. But
they had things like easier to select which font you were talking about, or downloadable fonts, or integrated print buffer sizes.
Oh, I forgot about that. There were fonts built into the printer. I completely and you can do a little test forgot page. About that. Yeah, because you're just basically sending a stream of ASCII stuff with a control code saying, print this in font number whatever. Completely forgot about that. Versus I think of it as you're sending a stream of, like in my mind nowadays, it would be, oh no, the computer will send a raster thing. Like here's a group of pixels, put that on the page. But that wasn't the case. You're sending text and it would render it out in the font that was built in the printer. Completely forgot about that.
Yeah. I actually don't know how you send graphics, but it was a new fancy thing that it could, that, you know, some could do, like you put it in receive pixels mode and it would,
it was escape codes. You could send escape codes and then tell it which of the 9 pins you want it to print.
Okay.
Or, you know, thusly.
Yeah. I think, I mean, the printer that, so I never actually owned this Epson printer, but I had this weird, situation when I was in, I guess it was late middle school, going into the beginning of high school, which is that, and I've probably talked about this before, but I worked for a local hotel as their programmer, their cheap kid labor programmer. And, as a result of that, I mean, I don't know, I don't think I did them any good, but as a result of that, I got to take home, I had a QX10 at home and one of these printers and like a 1200 baud modem in that machine. And so, and what I was doing was, in that domain was sort of like DBase programming, you know, DBase 2. But, so I had, you know, but of course I had these things, so it wasn't just like work. Actually, I have no idea why I needed the modem for work. I probably didn't. I used it entirely for non-work, but I used it a lot. But anyway, yeah. So the printer I think I liked the most probably though was the ImageWriter 2. I kind of came along after the ImageWriter 1 kind of came and went, but the ImageWriter 2 I got when I was sort of heading into the Mac world. And, you know, it's even like now I kind of like it as an object because it talks to everything. I mean, like within a small time frame, at least it can talk to all my machines. I could plug it into, you know, a Lisa, one of the Macs, I could plug it into with a card, I could plug it into an Apple II, you know? And so it's very versatile for the kind of thing that one might want to do now. And it can do color. It had a ribbon that the printhead could sort of shift up and down and aim at like red or green or blue or red or yellow or black or whatever. And so you would run, you know, you would completely run through all of your black, having used none of your yellow.
Well, the other thing was that it would kind of get a little smeared from time to time, with the lighter colors getting smeared by the darker colors. I can't remember which model it was, but Epson had one of those multicolor printers as well that did what you're talking about, where the ribbon would shift up or down, or maybe it was the printhead that shifted up or down. I can't remember, but and it could mix the colors by printing something and then going back and then printing it again, but wasn't great. But it was fun. Color was fun. I remember the first color printers, I was like, ooh, that's pretty.
Yeah.
Wasn't particularly useful.
I do remember being more impressed with how it looked in the 80s than I am now. The dots somehow have gotten, I don't know, larger with age. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, that I actually haven't, I didn't spend a lot of time printing. I was aware of print shop, but it never seemed like a good use of time to print a banner. So even then, I think I was sort of resource conscious. You know, it's like, this has got to be worth it for me to spend my ribbon and paper. You know, so I would print programs out, you know, if I needed to.
I found a manual for the old FX and MX printer line, and it turns out they didn't yet have fonts. Talks about how in later other things have those, but what it did have is you could pick between the way the pins are going to strike the paper. So at that era, you could do standard characters, you could do emphasized characters, which would strike, move it a tiny bit and strike again, double strike characters, makes it even a little wider and bolder, and then near letter quality, which would do it and shift down a bit. And those are your three choices. And then the LX also added compressed characters to be really small. And the big difference, it turns out, between the MX and the LX, my sleek LX, is you could pick those by pressing buttons on that in certain orders on the faceplate, instead of having to send character codes. That was the big difference. I could use those buttons, and I could pick near letter quality, baby. Near letter quality.
And if you wanted to sort of shift in a document, you could have your print program, you know, like put up a thing saying, you know, hit switch to near letter quality and then hit a key.
Right. So, yes.
Yeah, like a playing a keyboard of a sort.
Exactly. So it turns out that's the feature I had that I'm sure I used all the time. Maybe. I don't know. That was it. Love that printer.
I mean, we talk about 57 when IBM first started selling that printer, but really, I think of dot matrix printers from the personal perspective being like a late 70s, early 80s kind of phenomenon. And it seemed, you know, it seemed like they were around for a long time, but in reality, once laser printers started to get enough affordable where you could have one at home, it's just been that way ever since. I mean, there was inkjet. I had a couple inkjet printers. You guys probably did too.
Sure.
It seems like laser printers ultimately won the war of this, and dot matrix printers weren't really around that long for individual people.
And it wasn't that late. It was mid-80s, 80... I think the Apple LaserWriter came out in 85, and we had one at work in like 86 or something like that. Like it was, so that's not that late. If you think about it, like Apples were late 70s, and by 1985, people were already switching over to laser printers. It was just a world changer switching to laser printers.
There was thermal printers were in there but
I hated those from day one.
Yeah,
I was against there's certain technology. I was against faxes and I was against thermal printers. I took a lot of weird stands.
I mean, I guess, you know, they solved the noise problem, but at the cost of like the result.
Right. And the cost of all your papers becoming blank after a time. Like you print stuff out, come back to it 3 weeks later. Oh, this page is empty.
Yeah, I know. That is not great.
And by the way, the special paper that you paid more money for because you couldn't use regular paper.
Special.
And it probably also is like, you know, medically bad for you.
Right.
Had an interesting smell too. Do you remember that? The thermal paper is just, you're right. That couldn't have been very good for you.
I do have the Apple version of it was the silent type. And I've been meaning to get that going, but at some point I wonder if the paper is just going to become not print onable.
I mean, there's so many things we could talk about. We could talk about the printer wars. You remember the big players like Epson and Okidata and Star Micronics all, you know, trying to duke it out for market share. Those were interesting days, and all trying to come up with a common language. Like I remember everything was Epson compatible. So if you got an Okidata, you could flip the switches and
it
would pretend
it was
an FX.
I think, isn't that an album by Radiohead?
Yeah.
Is it? I don't know.
OK Computer, but every time you say it, I'm like, wait, I know that. Why do I know OK? It's messing with me. So in 1957, one other thing we should just at least mention was ARPA was created. And I recently read a book that I quite enjoyed. I put a link in the show notes. It's called Where Wizards Stay Up Late, which is about the origins of the internet. It starts in like the late 1950s, talks about the origins of ARPA and the people who did different stuff and the first RFC. And it's like just a dive into the creation of the internet. I don't know who this book is for other than like us and people who listen to this podcast. So it can't have been like a big seller, but it's really good. If you're interested in old computer stuff, it's an amazing overview of the origins of the internet. I really dug it.
Cool.
Yeah.
I had not heard of it. Jeremy in the chat also recommends it.
So you have, well done, Jeremy.
Two people recommending it.
Yeah. I dug it. It's an easy read. It's like sit down one evening, fly through it, but it's quite good. I quite liked it. And it's neat that some of the stuff we've talked about, like the Whirlwind computer, it gets mentioned. I'm like, oh, I know about that now.
Isn't there's some sort of effect that's, you know, like...
Oh, when you first hear about a thing, you hear about it all the time?
And then suddenly you hear it everywhere,
Everyone just keeps talking about that effect recently for some reason.
Right. And exactly. However, I can't remember the name of it. But as soon as I do, I will hear it everywhere, yes. We could probably move on from that unless you did want to talk about the printer wars.
Nope. I'm good.
Bader-Meinhof. I knew it would come back.
Yes.
Bader-Meinhof thing.
Yes, that's it. Okay. I actually not long ago. I'm super behind in podcasts because of the lack of commuting. But not long ago, I heard a pair of episodes of a podcast called The Omnibus Project, or Omnibus. I don't know if you are aware of this, but it is Ken Jennings, who he was like a, you know, like very successful Jeopardy player, like had the longest run or biggest winnings or something at some point, not too long ago. I think he actually was a guest host too, not too long ago. But he and John Roderick have a podcast together, and they do this, and it's basically the premise is essentially they're recording information for the future, given, you know, like in anticipation of civilization, you know, disintegrating. So they pick facts and talk about them, and it's, I don't know, it's pretty interesting. But at any rate, they talked a bit about the not only the effect, but also like what the original thing was, because the original thing was actually, you know, it was some sort of like protest or something. You know, it was some news item that then somebody noticed that as soon as they heard about it, then they heard about it everywhere, and so then there was also the effect, and it was named after that thing. So clearly I can retain nothing, but I remember where to find it. So I guess we can move to listener feedback. Okay, so Tony has emailed us about a trailer. I don't know anything about this other than this trailer. Atari 50, the anniversary celebration. Is this familiar to anybody?
It is not.
So I couldn't quite figure out what it even is. But I think it must be a game pack or something. You know, it's sort of like re-envisioning some of the old games, or maybe making them available on some platform. Anyway, I don't know what it is, but the trailer basically talks about how Atari, it's due to Atari that there are video games today. and so forth. But, and so anyway, it does seem like old things will get new treatments, which may or may not be a good thing. Anyway, so if you're interested in something like that, you could watch the trailer and also not be quite sure what it is. What else? Let's see. Tony also emailed us about another podcast. There are other podcasts. We've now mentioned a couple of them. This podcast is Multimedia Hyperguide, a Windows 3.1 podcast. So that's pretty niche. But Tony specifically was recommending episode 11, The History of After Dark. He thought it was quite interesting. So it's talking about Berkeley Systems and After Dark. And we talked a little bit about that at one point, but largely without facts, I think. So,
as we do.
Yeah.
That's how we get Quinn to come on the show.
Yeah.
We say a bunch of nonsense, and finally we anger her enough. She's like, oh, fine. I'll come on to correct you, boys.
Yeah. Halfway through the 20-page email, it's like, all right, forget this. I'm just going to come say it.
We can generate enough anger and enough response. She has to show up and actually join the show. It's great. It's worked out really well for us. Maybe not so much for her.
Tony sent us two other things, actually. Here's one of them. He wondered if we have ever talked about Retro Magazine. I don't know if that was a joke. We have repeatedly talked about Retro Magazine.
But never heard of it.
Issue 15 is out. And every time we talk about it, I read a little bit more about it. And so this time, now we do know it is, it's in Italian and English. It is now on issue 15. I remember, I think we talked about issue 10, because I remember observing that it would soon go to 11. And it is free. It is not in print. It's only PDF. And a new thing is that they have set up a nonprofit status for it to protect the name and also allow for donations if you want. You know, so you can become a member to support it, but you are not required to do so. And they say they will talk about details on that in the upcoming issues. So, but it's really quite interesting. It's very well done. So if you haven't looked at it, even though we repeatedly mention it, go take a look at it. I guess if I say that, it is known not to have an effect since you haven't done it.
Right.
But at any rate. Okay, let's see. What else? Have any of you actually looked through the previous issues?
I haven't. And I have a question about it, if you have. You know, there's this giant intersection between retro computing and retro gaming. Mm-hmm. Two are, you know, very much linked. Looking through some of the article titles that you just had up on screen, it looked like there was a good bit of gaming coverage in there. Do you know if that's what it tends to focus on? Is retro gaming more, or is it more retro computing in general, kind of like our podcast?
I think it's kind of both. It's not just gaming, for sure. So there's a lot of stuff about Intellivision and gaming and stuff, but I'm pretty sure that, you know, there's like a 10-line basic contest being reviewed, and I guess you're making games in 10 lines, but it definitely is not just games, though. It's also got programming and things like that in it, so.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and it's nicely laid out. You know, it's got a good sort of production value, good editorial contributions, so. Okay, let's see. Last thing. This could have been a news item. Maybe it should have been, but this is, I think this was also Tony. So thank you, Tony, for providing our content. This is a YouTube video of somebody implementing Commodore's IEC bus protocol on a KIM-1 single board computer. Earl, have you come across this, being the Commodore person?
I haven't. That's fascinating. The IEC bus protocol is kind of slow. So it seems like you're almost harming the KIM-1 make it use that slow protocol. But that's fascinating, though. And that's on the Commodore History YouTube channel. I'll check that out.
Yeah, it is pretty interesting. I sort of skimmed it, but it sort of talks a little bit about the KIM-1, which is basically, it's like a trainer, you know, kind of thing. It's got a keypad and it's got a couple of whatever you call them, 7-segment displays as its input and output. It had the capacity, I think, to save to tape if you had a interface board, and to paper tape, so various kinds of tape. But that was it. You know, I mean, like by the time the disk drive came out, there wasn't, you know, this the KIM-1 was no longer really a thing that they were, you know, concerned with. So the project was basically just to save data from a KIM-1 on a disk and load it back. And in fact, actually, what's kind of cool about it is that by doing it this way, enabled the, enabled the person who was doing it to actually like take it over to a C64, you know, write stuff on the disk, bring it to the KIM and read it back, or vice versa. You know, so it was very exciting. He saved, you know, some ones and twos and threes and was able to see it on the Commodore screen, or write them on the Commodore and then see it on the little display. So,
I mean, that really is kind of neat.
Yeah.
That's a neat idea.
You know, it's cool that it worked. It didn't have to work, and it is a project that probably doesn't have a huge audience, but it was fun to watch him enjoy succeeding.
Yeah.
So, anyway, yeah, take a look at it if that is a thing that is of interest to you.
KIM-1's been getting a lot of love lately. There's another YouTube channel that I watch called Dave's Garage, where he talks about a bunch of tech stuff. He's a retired Microsoft engineer. So he talks a lot about Microsoft stuff and behind-the-scenes stories and that kind of thing. But he also covers some retro things. And he bought a KIM-1 off of eBay that wasn't just a KIM-1. It was in a chassis with a bunch of add-on boards, and that is really this fascinating kind of conglomerated thing. But he's been covering how the different pieces work, and it's fascinating.
I wonder if we saw that auction. We might have. I sort of feel like we did see a sort of an elaborate KIM-1 not too long ago.
But. Well, it had that expansion, card edge, and so someone who built this monstrosity took full advantage of that expansion interface and added on memory and added on some sort of, a video interface. And it is just, it was like taking a KIM-1 and making it the tail that wagged the dog.
Uh-huh. This might be the video you're talking about. It's unboxing the KIM-1.
That looks like it. Yep.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind having one. I don't know if I would. It's a 6502, right? I mean, it's basically a 6502 trainer type thing.
Yeah, I think it's what they put together to help promote the 6502 mm-hmm. and teach people how to use it so that they could integrate it into their own projects. And then, yeah, like these things do, it kind of took on a life of its own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, speaking of eBay, I think this isn't a super recent email, but Sid over email asked where we get our things, you know, like eBay or thrift stores or like estate sales or like how do we find things?
Where do I get my many things?
Yeah.
I mean, lately, it's just the luck of the draw. Like somebody hears you're into retro computers and like I got some old thing that's in my basement or whatever. And, you know, because I used to go to thrift stores a lot in my early days of retro collecting. And that was great for a while. And then it really dried up. And then you would do what I was just talking about. You'd be talking to friends and they'd find out you're into old computers and there'd be something in the attic or in the basement that they'd just give to you that these days it costs you $300 on eBay or more. And you can look at eBay, but boy, the prices are pretty high there. We cover eBay stuff every time we do the podcast, but there's been, I think inflation in the retro computing world has probably outpaced just standard inflation. It's as these things die and that kind of thing, it's just become harder and harder. I didn't have a good answer. I saw that email come in and I was like, man, I don't know. I mean, I'm at the point where I want to start downsizing my collection instead of buying more stuff.
And it's funny because it's all tech that wasn't designed to last forever. So it's like this race between which is going to die first, the collectibles or the collectors? Because they're right. Both heading for an end, but which is going to run out sooner?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's frustrating when you realize, you know, like particularly these sort of middle era things that had batteries in them, you know, it's like, the Apple 2GS, what were they thinking? It's soldered in. I mean, you know, like it's a battery and you have to cut it out.
They were thinking it would last for 4 years and then you'd buy the next thing.
That's so unlike Apple.
I do think that people forgot that batteries do this, you know, or something. Like it's there are a lot of things that where it just like they it doesn't seem like they considered the fact that you would actually need to replace a battery. But yeah, and I mean, like, well, with like old iPhones too, I mean, what's going to happen to that? I mean, it's just going to, like, at some point you're going to look in the box that used to have your iPhone 1 in it, and it's going to be just like a melted, you know, melted through the floor.
Expanded thing ready to explode.
But
over a long enough time frame, all iPhones will expand to take all available space.
Right.
Well, I mean, you used to take stuff and stick it in a box or stick it in the garage. These days, thankfully, we're a lot more recycling conscious. So you take your recycling somewhere where they can do good e-cycle. And that's great, except I think the fact that that is the case means that the retro enthusiasts of 20 to 30 years from now, what are they going to have? Because all the stuff will have gone through the recycle process.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it would have lasted anyway. I mean, like you're saying, you know, the plastic or the rubber pieces of it like decay and turn to goo. And I had a tablet, an HP tablet. HP's pretty high quality stuff typically, right? I had one of these tablets and it, after about 3 years, 3.5 years, the screen just got really melty. It looked like everything you look on it looked like a Salvador Dali painting. Uh-huh. And so I don't know what happened to that I didn't leave it out in the sun or anything. It was always in a nice environment and it just turned to goo. And so I recycled it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that with like cassette, like what VCRs and cassette players also have these like I guess it's rubber. I don't know what it is. The little wheels that melt.
And belts. I reconditioned a VCR recently and opened up, and the problem with it was there's a belt that was rubber at some point, and that was mostly like a flypaper. It was just like the sticky goo. Turns out belts for that kind of thing are readily and cheaply available. So it was the world's easiest electronic change. That was the only thing I had to do. No batteries, no anything. It worked great.
Excellent.
So now I have a top-loading VCR. What will I do with that? Nothing.
Yeah, you know, top-loading might actually be...
It looks great. It's so beautiful. But you can't put anything on it.
Nice.
Because it comes up and I don't have any tapes or a thing that could connect to it. But it's beautiful and it works now, apparently.
Yeah, I want a VCR to archive tapes. But all the ones that I have are the front loading normal kind. And I just worry about them because, I mean, like you put it in and it just goes away. And
you'll never see that again.
I mean,
like the old 800K drives in the Apple, it ingests it. It'll never spit it back out again.
Yeah. I'm well familiar with a cassette player eating a tape, or getting it. But the thing is that if it happens in a VCR, there's nothing you can do. I mean, I probably will try to operate this with the top off, but even with that off, it doesn't, it's still hard to get at anything. But I was just thinking maybe a top loading one might provide more access to a grabbed tape like that.
I would suspect if you're archiving, it's much better to get a super modern one. They made VCRs right up to the area where you could get a VCR that was also a DVD player. I think something like that's more likely to just be gears and not belts is the way to go.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I probably would want to do
something. Top loading means it's from the 70s or something. It's going to be all just goo on the inside like mine was.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess there's a line though, because like probably the last ones produced were also made super cheaply.
Oh, right. So okay.
You want to back up
upscalers maybe built in? Like if you got one that's also a DVD player, or maybe VCR/Blu-ray, did that exist? And would have like HDMI out with an upscaler, like to get a nice archive copy that way.
Yeah. I have no idea how I'd find it, but there was a YouTube video where this enthusiast who collected VCRs told you all about the different brands and which ones were more likely to last and which ones were more likely to break. And I mean, I can't make fun because look at what I collect, right? Mm-hmm. But the video, this guy panned out and there was this giant wall of VCRs of all kinds. I mean, there had to be like 200-300. I don't think I'm exaggerating. It's just this giant thing of shelves of VCRs, but he definitely knew what he was talking about. And if I remember right, I think the old Panasonics were ones he didn't like. Like he was saying, stay away from those, they'll break down. But there were a couple brands that he did like. If you can find that YouTube video, I mean, out in the sea of YouTube. Mm-hmm. But very informative, I thought. And if you're going to look for something to help you archive stuff, go find that video. I mean, there's not that many videos on YouTube. I'm sure you could find it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, if I had a wall of VCRs, I mean, one of the problems with these...
I like how Paul can't just have a VCR. Now you have to have a wall of VCRs.
Well, see, the thing is that the problem with archiving tapes is that it's a one-time speed activity.
Oh, right. You're archiving a two-hour tape. It takes 2 hours to do it. Right, okay.
Yeah. So
yeah, but you do one a day then.
You could do 300 at once.
Well, okay. It's taking so long to collect 300 VCRs, you could just do one thing a day for a year and have 300 archives. Yeah. I'm afraid of my VCR because as a minimalist, I still have a collector's heart. Like I covet things. I covet old industrial things. I love old movies. I love tactile things. And I can see me turning around one day and go, wait, how did I get 500 VHS tapes of 80s horror movies? How did that happen? So I'm afraid that this VCR is a gateway drug to me becoming a collector again. But I'm hoping not. We'll see.
Yeah, but the problem is, just like with floppy disks, you would have a hard time finding tapes that haven't decayed and aren't starting to go bad.
Would I? Or so is that part of the
same,
fun?
Same trouble.
Yeah.
So in answer to the question, where do we get our things? I don't have anything particularly different to say. I do find that it's harder to find things, but then I still hear stories of people wandering into fairly amazing collections. And, you know, something like an estate sale works It used to work pretty well because, you know, there would be somebody who kept a bunch of stuff from the 80s or whatever. Now it may also work fairly well because it's a collection somebody curated from right. the 80s.
I still, every once in a while, look on that. We talked about this site a while ago, that Max Sold site, which is, instead of eBay, it's just local sales and a lot of estate sales and stuff. And so, but the stuff doesn't go on cheap on there either because all the eBay people are also looking on there.
Right.
Well, the other thing that used to be good was government sales, but I don't think that's as good anymore because the stuff is getting so old that even the government's got rid of it at this point.
Except for the, you know, controlling the nuclear launch codes or whatever.
Except for, the PDP-11, keeping the reactor safe.
All right. We can probably leave the feedback there, given that the clock is ticking right along. What is next? The next are the items of interest and news. Carrington has the first of those, and I will show you.
Oh, right. Okay, so it's 50 years since the... Not to the day, but there's a site, or I found a neat article, celebrating 50 years of small talk. I have always had a soft spot for small talk, not small talk the thing, small talk the object-oriented language. It was the first object-oriented language I ever used. I knew C, but I had not played with C++ yet. And so the first time I ever dealt with objects or the idea of objects or anything like that was with small talk. I think small talk 80. My main memory was it was only 5 or 6 reserved keywords. Like Smalltalk, especially the beginning, was famous for its teeny tiny syntax. And it was like true, false, nil, self, super, I can't remember, and one other word. And that was it. Those were the only reserved words in the entire language. And in this article, they even show, the postcard. This is kind of a famous thing, like the complete syntax on a postcard. Like, so they were going for this easy syntax, although if you read this, it doesn't look that easy, but the language was easier to remember. So this for me predated C++, although C++ existed, I think, before this, but whatever. But before I spent any time with Objective-C or any of that, was Smalltalk. So I have such a soft spot for this lovely language. And you know, object-oriented languages are kind of the way the world went, and Smalltalk is generally considered to be incredibly influential. So nowadays, if you're using Java or Python or Ruby or whatever, or Objective-C or Swift, I'm using a lot of Swift now, all of it, you know, owes something to Smalltalk. Smalltalk was the one. And in this article, it talks about very recently, the latest Smalltalk gathering. Turns out, just like Kansas Fest, there's still a thing called Camp Smalltalk Supreme or whatever. And they have keynote speakers, give out awards and all that, and that's still a thing that happens. And how cool is that? So pretty awesome. So they had a birthday cake, and they celebrated the 50th anniversary of Smalltalk at this conference.
It was just a month ago.
And I didn't know about it, and I just think it's delightful. I love that they're still, like, fans of the language. I would consider myself a fan of language, having not touched it for 30 years or whatever.
That's right. It was right there in Toronto.
Right here
in Toronto. That skyline.
So, Toronto does great things. It's got me. It's got small talk. I could have gone to this. I didn't. Mm-hmm. Oh, well. So I missed out. But I was excited. I was excited to like kind of be reminded of small talk. So that said, have either of you any experience with small talk? Did you ever play with it? Did you ever get paid to program it?
No, I have a question for you, though. What platform did you use Smalltalk?
I used it at university, but I wasn't at university at the time. I went to a programming camp when I was in junior high. I think it's before even high school. There was this thing in the summer where you could go and sit down at a bunch of terminals, and there were also like computers. And at the time, I didn't know the difference between like what's a terminal, what's a mini computer, what's an actual micro. I don't know. I sat in front of a thing that had a screen and a keyboard, and they taught us some language stuff, and they introduced us to Smalltalk. And there was somebody there from IBM who was pushing it. Like it was an IBM person kind of teaching the kids, here's the languages of the future. And it was just like, it was, and I didn't understand. I'm like, why would I want an object? Like, I don't even, like at the time I barely knew what a function was. So I was like, I don't know. It's this thing. But I got the concept of like passing messages and stuff. And I thought that was really cool. But then I never really got into object stuff until I got something really easy. I think it was HyperCard. When I started doing stuff in HyperCard, then I finally went, okay, I get it. There's this card. It can get a message. It can do stuff. And that kind of unlocked object programming in my mind. But I loved Smalltalk.
I think it actually predates C++ by quite a bit.
Oh, does it? Oh, really? Oh, wow. I was assuming it came out at the same time, and then C++ ate its lunch.
No, is it? Well, I mean, if it just celebrated 50 years, wouldn't that be 1972?
Yes, it would. He said, hedging his bet.
I thought C++ was a child of the 80s.
Aren't we all? oh, yeah, look at that. 1983. You're right. Wow. C++ still ate its lunch, though. Like sorry, small talk. I love you, but C++ walked all over you.
you asked if we had any experience in it. I didn't, but I was under the impression that Objective-C that I did try to learn for a while until it finally just melted my brain was had a lot that it derived from small talk.
I would say probably yes. I spent tons of time programming in Objective-C, like because of Apple stuff. So much programming in Objective-C. Oh my gosh. Probably more than any other language.
I really liked Objective-C. Yep. I came from just C, you know, and so it just seemed like magic, you know.
Did it
like,
seem weird to you that everything started with NS until you realized why? Because I was like, why does everything start with NS?
It didn't because I was programming on a Next.
Okay, that's why. Because for those who didn't program on a Next, I was like, okay, can someone please explain? I remember asking at either a... I don't know, a Macworld or something. It's like, okay, what's up with the NS? What does it stand for? I had to be told. I couldn't figure it out on my own. I'm not a smart person.
That was a huge aha moment when I was looking through the code, and I saw that too. And I was thinking, and then all of a sudden it just struck me. Ah, next step.
Didn't strike me. I had to be told.
Yeah. I was wondering if we were going to ever reveal it to someone who was listening but didn't yet know.
Oh, right.
Because we had been talking around it the entire time. But, yeah, next step.
Next step, yes.
Yeah.
NS. Everything starts with NS.
I had, in college, I had a, like a, we had a little Next lab, and I had a summer job, you know, working for it. Actually, Jack also, he was sort of more like the tech guy, you know, one of the tech guys at the Next lab, and I was sort of there doing programming, I think mostly working for the math department. But at any rate, so they sent a couple of us to a programming sort of like, I don't know, school. It was like a couple days just sort of learning how to program on the Next. And so one thing I remembered from that, I mean, it was basically teaching us how to use Objective-C and write stuff in it. And the main thing that I remember learning there was always copy and paste. if you're trying to replicate some code somewhere else, copy and paste it. Because you're always going to make a typo. So that's it's probably pretty wise. I actually have been trying to follow that. So
as we're talking, I'm reading more and more about this Camp Smalltalk, which took place right here in my own city month ago and was free and had two of like the Smalltalk creators at Xerox PARC talking at it. And we're teaching like, and I seriously missed out. I wish I had known about this ahead of time. Oh, my gosh. Rats.
Do they have any of it on video?
I don't know. I don't care. I missed out. Now I'm just going to pout about it. This looks like it was amazing, and I missed everything, and it's right here. Ah! Darn it.
It's interesting. So right below the two keynote speakers. Oh, maybe were there four? Maybe there are four keynote speakers. Adele Goldberg.
That's how good this was. Four
Dan
keynote
Ingles.
Speakers.
Yeah. I would have gone if it were right next door.
I didn't go, even though it was right next door. Wow. That was...
Sorry.
Oh, well. I don't know if I'm even at the point yet where I want to go to physical gatherings. I mean, would I really gone and gotten a group of... Do I want to die for small talk?
It does sort of feel like... it would be interesting to know that it was there, but maybe it's just as well not to.
A little too early.
I found out a little late.
Yeah. But anyway, I missed out. Disappointed. Love small talk though. So still have a soft spot for small talk, even though I'd used it very little.
Yeah, and I feel like I still don't know anything about it. I just know that it's like it's the thing people say when they talk about object-oriented programming.
Right. It's like, oh, that thing.
Like having seen that postcard, I now know twice as much as I used to.
Right.
Okay, we can move on to the next item of interest and news. That is Earls.
Okay, so have either of you played Wordle?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I haven't played it yet.
I
play
a
lot of Words with Friends, but I haven't played Wordle. Don't know anything about it. Just know that it is an incredible craze. Sweeping the world. And the TRS-80 folks want it to be on the TRS-80 platforms also. So I'm going to talk about the TRS 8-bit 2022 programming competition, which is one that we didn't talk about recently on Next Without 4. We just got done covering a bunch of programming contests, but this wasn't one of them, and it sounds like a lot of fun. So I'm going to read this pretty much straight off of Vintage's The New Old, which is where this story comes from.
Great site.
Which is an awesome site.
Yeah, highly recommended. I really like
it. You should stop listening to the podcast right now and go to that site.
You can multitask. You can do both. You can read that and listen.
Yeah.
So from that site, it says, Wordle is everywhere except on TRS-80s, and this competition aims to change that. There are two tracks, Beauty and the Beast. So in the Beauty category, you're trying to make the prettiest version of Wordle for the TRS-80. It doesn't have to support the whole Wordle dictionary, so you can just concentrate on the looks. And I'm lying because I'm paraphrasing. I'm not reading it straight off the site, but that's okay. So they do say, though, and this is a direct quote, use whatever language you like for the job, Basic, Assembly, C, COBOL, etc. And you have to be pretty hardcore to want to do COBOL. The other category is Beast. Beast entrants will tackle the problem of squeezing all 12,960 five-letter words of the dictionary into a TRS-80.
Oh, interesting. So yeah, because that's the hard part, is getting the dictionary in there. Squeezing it, I think, is the hard part.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you'd have to compress it somehow, right? Because if I'm just doing the math, 13,000 words at five letters, you've already run out of RAM.
Well, no, because if you think about it, you'd only need uppercase letters. You only need letters. Mm-hmm. You don't need spaces. Don't need punctuation. Don't need anything. So you got 26 letters, which is basically 3 1/4 bytes. And most of the letters are going to barely be used. So my first thought would be you'd use 2 bytes for most of the letters and then have some sort of way to switch and say the last byte tells me that the second position is some weird obscure thing. Because you do have letter frequency. Anyway, that's interesting. Interesting is a programming challenge. I like it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well done.
No, I got nothing working.
Well, it says, by the way, this is for assembly language programmers only. The smallest blob of programming data will win. So download the, there's a contest.zip file, and I guess we can have a link to that. This itself on the Vitno site is a link to the TRS-80, to the TRS-8-bit newsletter, I think from June. So there are word lists, specific requirements for the Beast entries, details on how Wordle works, and I guess I should take a look at that, because I honestly, I don't know how the game works. Is it easy to describe?
Yes.
How do you Wordle?
You have to guess a five-letter word. It's like the old Mastermind game. Do you remember that? Where you would guess and it would say, oh, you've got two letters correct in the correct location. In this case, you are told, you guess a five-letter word, and then you're told for each letter, is it correct and in the right location, or is it a letter in the word but not in the right location, or is it not a letter in the word? And you have five guesses to guess. You guess five different words, and you got to try to find the correct word in five guesses. Really straightforward, but fun.
Interesting.
Interesting as a word puzzle. I like it. Do it every day.
So I put on the screen Untitled Word Game Pro, which is a Apple II version of Wordle that's that 4AM and Cucumba put together. And there are two of them, actually. This, the Untitled Word Game, runs on an Apple II from 1977, and this one runs on an Apple IIe from 1983. But they were solving exactly that problem. I mean, like, it's, and in fact, the Pro version is much faster at traversing the list, but it's somehow managed, they managed to get a lot of words in there. So it's pretty amazing. But yeah, so you type in a word, it thinks for a little bit, tells you which letters are in and which letters are in the wrong place. So this has told me that C, A, and N are in the word, but in the wrong place. And so you just sort of like keep working from there. And eventually, you know, so now I know.
All the letters.
Yeah. Right.
Cool. Well, two other details. I mean, you can go read the article on the site, especially if you're interested in jumping in and giving this a try, which if you are a TRS-80 programmer of any variety, I think you should. Because One of the other details you should know, this seems to be open to any TRS-80. So it's Model 1, 3, 4, 2, 12, 16, COCO 1, 2, 3, Model 100, MC-10. So if it says TRS-80, you probably can program it for this contest. And it says that the entries will be judged by the hosts of the Trash Talk podcast. Hmm. There's an address to send them to, and the deadline is November 24th, 2022. So this just seemed like a lot of fun.
Ah, that gives you plenty of time to manage it, too.
So ways out.
Plenty of time to think about it and not do anything and then procrastinate and then suddenly realize, oh, God, I got 40 hours.
And then right in the last week.
Because exactly. That is how one does hobbies.
You guys are true programmers, I can tell. Yep.
Very cool. Okay. I guess I talked a fair amount about the listener feedback, so I won't worry about the fact that my thing is actually quite short.
Short but exciting.
On our Facebook page, there was a post from David All who said that this is, he provided a public notice that he says, this is a public notice that I am formally placing everything that I've written or edited into the public domain. And he actually goes on to say that this he thought he had done this, you know, in the past, but this is sort of like an explicit statement of it. And I've seen this shared around a fair bit, you know, because it was sort of newsworthy that we had a thing that says, you know, you can, you know, whatever the basic games book and all that stuff are now in the public domain. I think it actually was originally posted on our Facebook page. I think this is where the screenshot came from. So nobody actually credits us when they share the screenshot around, but that's okay. I think that's pretty cool.
I think it's amazing.
The
fact that he's putting it in the public domain and the fact that David All posts in our Facebook group. Those are awesome things.
Yeah. So thank you, David, for doing that.
It's not the first time, by the way. He's posted on other things, but this this was, I thought, particularly newsworthy.
Yeah. And it's definitely worth just like keeping an eye on our Facebook group for things he posts, because he has been sort of periodically posting about, you know, something he's putting on eBay. You know, it'll be like some whatever magazine from something, or, you know, I forget what the last one was, but, and often it seems like they don't go for much. I mean, like, you know, so if you're interested in them, you don't tend to have a lot of competition for them. So it's good to know about them. Cause I think the last thing he posted was, you know, it was a print artifact, went for like $7 or something, you know, so, it's not, I wouldn't consider it to be advertising. I would consider it to be, you know, alerting people that something is available.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And for those, I don't know if you mentioned, but for those who don't know, he made a bunch of like computer books in the 80s, especially programming things with creative computing, like the basic things, type-in books and stuff. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. I guess we should have said who he was for the people who don't know. But I think founder of Creative Computing Magazine. And also, you know, the basic computer games books. Okay, that was it. That was all I wanted to say. I was just amused at the fact that like I recognized that screenshot that people were sharing around. So I think I will leave it at that. We all had only one thing.
That still makes it a 3-hour podcast.
But that's fine. We can now go to a word from our sponsor.
It may be the computer age, but business still runs on paper. And when you're ready to put it on paper, you're ready for Okidata. Okidata personal printers. We put business on paper.
I'm holding an Epson printer, the single largest selling brand of computer printers in the United States today. We're talking state of the art. But are we talking fragile? It's made by Epson. Sensitive? A printer that can't take the grind? This is an Epson. Why do you think so many people are buying an Epson to go with their Apples and IBMs? Tell them.
And we're back. The host's retro computing gift idea this time is 50 Years of Text Games, the book. Carrington, did you know about this?
Yes, like, and you
were aware of the
I was aware,
the
and
site.
I chucked money toward the Kickstarter, and I'm super, mm-hmm. super, super excited about it.
Yeah, it looks really cool.
Yes.
If you wanted to talk about it, I mean, you know more about it than I do, I think.
But. Sure. So it's a book, and there's been a website, 50 years of text adventures, or 50 mm-hmm. years of text games or whatever, which is an incredible website, and just like these unbelievably detailed and lovely articles, basically for each year. And just Kate and I have talked about it a few times on various episodes of Eaten by a Grew, and they're just like deep dive articles into amazing stuff, especially the earlier things. Really well written, great research. Every article is fascinating, and so this now puts these and more together in a book to be published. And I'm super, super, super excited. Like, it's just, the book is going to be incredible. The website is incredible. Everything about this is incredible. So I'm just, like I say, just can't wait.
I think we had promised at one point to talk about 1992 Silver Wolf and then never got around to it.
Oh, okay.
but because I have this feeling like we have a pending obligation that we never did quite get around to. But this the Kickstarter was amazing. I mean, it was. I think the original goal was $29,000. It got funded at $523,000. So,
I mean, that's kind of life changing money when you get to there. That's amazing. There's a really good interview with the creator. Mm-hmm. on the podcast Advent of Computing. So if you're interested in hearing more about this, should give that a listen.
Yeah. Oh, I always mentioned his name. It's Aaron Reed. Aaron A. Reed, I think, to separate him from a different Aaron Reed who's on the internet, a bodybuilder or something. So Aaron A. Reed, mm-hmm. Who's just brilliant and a great writer, and I'm just a big fan.
And surely any recipient of this gift would appreciate it, but you could also give it to yourself.
So it's a Kickstarter. I think it's too late to get on the Kickstarter, or can you just pre-order now or something?
Yeah, it's been switched to a pre-order site. Yeah.
Because it's been funded. It's been, like you say, funded 1,000 times over.
Yeah, you can get, so it's on backerkit.com. Okay. There's a site that you can get to where if you want to, you can just get a digital version for $25, paperback for $45, Ultimate Collector's Edition for $195, which includes a bunch of, like, feelies.
Right? How cool is that?
But yeah, so I mean, you can even get a physical edition of it. It's not super cheap, but it's worthy. So but even though the Kickstarter is over, it is possible to still get in. That's good enough for now. We can now
good
turn our
for
attention
us.
To eBay. And Carrington has the first of these.
I do,
and yet has no ability to share.
Nope. I guess I do, but I can describe them. Paul can share them.
So,
whatever. It's all good.
I'll start opening tabs.
But. Yeah, I'll start opening those tabs, and I will tell you about my first things. My first try, I've picked a series of games and game-related things. Some worth buying, some not worth buying, all of which I found interesting. The first is so much money. So crazy. What the heck? Not even possibly worth it money. Very rare game by Online Systems, which went on to become Sierra, and it's the Thrilogy. So it's three very simple games. Asking price of $25,000. So it's a sealed Thrilogy. Doesn't come up much. If you are a collector of Apple II games and you want one of the rarest games in sealed condition, this is one of the rare opportunities to get that. Are these games worth that? No, they are not. You can go on, you can see, like, there's people, the game is available. You can download the game, you can play it. Like, it's three different games. The most interesting of the three is one where you are playing William Tell and you're shooting an arrow and you got to shoot two apples out of trees and one apple up the head of your son. And if you aim too low, you can kill your kid in funny ways, shoot the arrow into his head or his groin and stuff. It's kind of funny. But super simple game, $25,000 for what is essentially a baggie, a little folded piece of paper, and a floppy disk is obscene amount of money. Like, come on, crazy. But if you've got all the money in the world and you want to collect the whole set of Apple II software unopened, this is one of your chances to go that. So drop $25,000, then you and Paul will both have copies. I don't know.
It's my trademark. I got to point out, there's a make offer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously the value of this is not the code or anything like that. It's only the provenance, really.
Right. Because it's super early. It's not the 1980 game. Though I don't think it's 19. I should have looked that up. I think this is 1981 or two. I don't think it's first year online systems. I think it's. Is it?
It's. I don't know, but it is. It's
super early.
I've
it's
never
really,
come
really
across
early.
This.
Well, that's it. Like, you just don't see it. And the fact that it's not only here, but it's sealed. I was like, oh my goodness, you don't see this one much. So it's super early. It's first or second year of online systems. So it's like really, really, really early game. Sold on Computerland for $24.95. That is a good return on investment, is what I say.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
1,000 times
well, I mean,
more.
Actually, I wonder if that is
how did
how
they not
price,
price it as
24,900? It's pretty close. It's yeah.
No, I'm making an offer of 1,000 times more than the original price. But anyway, you don't see it much. Yeah. So it's interesting to look at it. It's cool to see it. But I can't imagine why anybody would spend $25,000 on this, but whatever. So that's my first one. Thought it was interesting. Because baggy software for the Apple II goes for a lot of money. So.
Yeah. And I mean, so one issue with that is that there was actually fairly recently, I don't want to talk about it too much just because I don't know it like that much, but there's a fairly big...
fraud thing going on.
Right, exactly.
But was that for Apple II software? No, for something else.
Oh, yeah, no. It was... I mean, essentially what happened was... that I think somebody imaged got a disk from somebody and imaged it, and you know, it turned out that it was a pirated copy. You know,
people were starting to look at like the packaging even and going, wait, hold on, this is not. And so so it's big old scandal.
So this label
right
was like cut. And when you have things that could go, I mean, I don't actually believe that someone would.
But
is it going to buy it at this price? But I mean, it's still worth forging at a certain level.
Right. Who knows what's inside that? You can only find out by opening it up and ruining the value. I love to open up sealed software though. So if you do buy it, open it. Come on, do it. So that's my first. Baggy software for the Apple II goes for tons.
Well, what counts as an opened Ziploc?
Well, this is like stapled shut, I think. Probably stapled right to the floppy. Yes, what does count as an open? who knows? So that's my first one. My second one is, it ended. I thought somebody's going to be able to get this one really cheap. Baggy software for $5. I want to go the opposite direction. So Checkers gave for the Apple II, still sealed, and it was only $5. It was going to be my big thing. Like you could buy, instead of $25,000, buy something for us. So somebody snagged it. So Checkers game, Checkers by David Slate, sealed for the Apple II, $5. I'm like, when do you get to buy sealed software for the Apple II for $5? And probably more fun than the Trilogy. So... But somebody snagged it. Oh, well. Was it one of you guys? Did you see it in my list?
No. No. But I have another – I think I have another version of this.
I've seen it come up. This comes up, and it's not super rare or expensive. But I thought – I like the juxtaposition between one's $25,000 and one's $5. Right.
There is, I think, like a trilogy of games. So Destiny made also a chess game. Maybe. But – And it came in a sort of a fatter plastic package. This I can show. This is what I was thinking of for the chess one.
Okay. More like a snapper case kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, I see checkers on there.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, I can see the pictures. Yes, chess, checkers, and Odin, which is Othello. But I guess maybe whoever owns Othello, I think was
litigious.
They went after the people who used the name, right? So people would always, you know, whatever, make Riversy or or Odin.
Right.
So I guess I was just gonna say I've only seen them in this box form, not in the baggy form that you found. But
$5. My third choice is interesting in that no one knows how to pronounce it, and I'll tell you how to pronounce it. It's Krotica. All you other people are weirdos. The Karateka people, come on. Whatever. Every time I think someone says Karateka, it's because as a kid they would tell you it's not pronounced karate, it's karate. I'm like, okay, it's Karateka. It's like, whatever, dude. Nope, you had no friends. What I find interesting about this, go back one, this picture.
It's
boxed Apple II version of Karateka, which I think of as an Apple II game first.
Yeah.
But the label, as often happens, is starting to peel away, and under it, you can see a Commodore label. So this is a Commodore box that it looks legit. I think they reused the Commodore box and stuck Apple II labels over them. So either the Commodore version didn't sell as well, so they're reusing the box, or they had too many of them, or the Apple II version kept selling longer or something. But I find it interesting that they reused a Commodore box and stuck an Apple label over it. And that looks super legit to me. I think Brodebrand was just using their Commodore box and say, hey, we've run out of stock or whatever, labeled it up as Apple II, stuck an Apple II stuff in it, and there you go. So I find that makes it all the more interesting. Plus, I thought it was nice to show people this box because everyone had this game. I wonder how many of you have ever seen the box.
Right.
A lot of people did not buy this game and yet had it.
Yeah, see, this kind of thing with the peeling label, I think that's one of the most interesting things about getting a real legit thing. You know, like, if rather than getting a reproduction, you know, even if you intended to get a reproduction, there are people who make reproductions, you know, openly, and
sure,
and I can understand that. I mean, like, you want something that looks nice, that is like what you remember, you know, not this mashed up thing that got wet, you know,
right
20 years ago.
Right.
So,
but this is fascinating, the provenance of this.
Yeah, you learn something, or you can deduce something about the production of the title from stuff like this. Or, like, I've seen also some similar, like, discs with other labels stuck on top of earlier labels and that kind of stuff.
So I found this very, 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 very cool. Fascinating. So, anyways, and it's you know, $150 because it is a game that is super popular still, and it's a boxed version. You don't see it in the box much because everybody pirated this game. Oh my gosh. But it's, you know, one of the great Apple II games. If you don't know, and if you've never done it, you get an original disc of this. You should put it in your computer, put the disc in upside down. And if you don't know why, then just do it. I don't want to spoil it for you. Super fun. Shows the back of the disc here. Very, very fun to put this disc in upside down in your computer. Anyway, one of the great Apple II games, a neat box, but I love this little hint on the label there. I think that was really cool. So. And I got one other, which is game related. And this one's fun. One of my favorite Apple II games of all time. $95 for a copy of, it says, the Apple II PC, whatever. Wasteland for the Apple II is one of the all-time great games. Love it, love it, love it. But if you get it, you want to get the first publication of it, which is this one. And it's hard to tell from the outside which is the first publication. But you can tell because it includes a thing that later ones didn't, and nothing but the Apple II included it, which is the Wasteland Survival Guide. It's basically like a hint book that came in the game. But it's not like a normal hint book. It's written as like a diary of the characters that kind of came before you and what happened in their game. And so it's a diary of one of the characters. And so you can read, well, when they went to the town, what did they, oh, we talked to this guy and we couldn't buy anything from the store. We got ambushed in this alley. And so, you know, if you go in that alley, you're going to get ambushed. So it's one of the most creative and best written hint guides ever. And it came only with the first version and only for the Apple II. So a lot of times, a lot of Commodore 64 people seem to sell Wasteland plus this thing. But it never, as far as I know, ever came with the Commodore 64 version. You could only get it with the first edition of Apple II. And so it's cool. And so if you want to get this game, you want to get this version. And normally this sells for more than this. $100 is a good price for a completed version of Wasteland without this. And I think this person doesn't realize that it's complete because they say flat box only. I think they think this came in a bigger thing. But the flat box was the packaging. Like, this is a complete set. So for $100, I think it's a good buy because it's got the survival guide. It's all about the survival guide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is one of those. It's a little bit like a, you know, a record or whatever. You know, it opens up gatefold thing.
Like a double album record thing. Exactly. Yeah, with a ridiculous picture. I don't know if you can see if there's a photo of the inside. It opens up and you can see there it is. The developers all dressed up in their Wasteland cosplay.
Yeah, that's pretty excellent.
Just, my goodness, looking all hardcore. But when you look at the photo, you can tell it's a bunch of computer nerds dressed up like they're LARPing. They're not as cool as it's. Anyway, but I love it. The game is amazing. The packaging is really cool. I love how the game ends. It was one of my favorite gaming experiences. But in particular, the Wasteland Survival Guide is a treat. If you don't want to drop $100 on this, you just want to play the game because the game is readily available for Apple, for Commodore, for a bunch of things. You can play it in emulation. We're also going to have a link to the survival guide as a PDF. You can simply download it as a PDF, and you have everything you need to now play this game and not spend anything. And highly worth playing. So the PDF is great. So, but it is very much a like a kind of a walkthrough of the game, but again, written in diary form. So it's great. So that's it. Those are my choices. Paul should buy them all, including the $25,000 trilogy.
Yeah, excellent. I think I won't. Thank you. All right, so Earl has the next thing.
So we were talking about printers.
This is the one I had. About, this we is, the, this about, is the terrible printer I had.
Well, so here's the thing. I think there are like three different versions of this, right? Like a Commodore version, an Atari version, a TRS-80 version. And it's not really a printer. It's a plotter.
It's
and it has pens.
Delightful and useless.
Yeah, well, that's part of the reason why I want one of these. I really want one of these. But, and, you know, I think there's a whole community out there now for this particular mechanism to have things like repair parts or like there's a little gear, I think, or something like that that goes haywire that you can replace. But the key issue is the pens. I guess I should describe what I'm talking about. This is a Radio Shack. And can you swing back to the model number? It's a CGP-115 graphics printer slash plotter with manual. And I think the fact that it comes with a manual is actually pretty cool because all the Radio Shack documentation was great. But it's in the, what are they, I think they called it the Mercedes Silver color scheme, which is like the Model 1, Model 3 kind of color scheme. And it's a little... It's got to be like 4 inches wide or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, the paper is like as wide as a hand. It's Oh my gosh, I'm just having nostalgia overload looking at these photos. In previous episodes, I've talked about that terrible, stupid, little useless printer I had for my Coco with the teeny tiny little pens that would write. Mm-hmm. And this is it. I haven't seen it in forever. It's so much fun.
Well, yeah, Your antipathy may be my desired collectible
I
item.
I almost want to pull the trigger on this thing. I'm liking looking at it so much. I've got it open. I almost hit buy it now. I love this thing so much. Oh, because it has these tiny, tiny little pens, like little, like you know, 1 centimeter long pens that are each a different color. You put them in, and like you say, it's a plotter. It draws everything. It writes out the letters, but it's printed out on like 3.5 inch wide paper. So as a kid trying to do like maybe an essay for school, it's like here's the receipt for my essay.
Yeah,
that's hilarious. No, I want one of these though. I want one that works or that I can at least repair. But the key issue is I want to. There's been all kinds of conversations that I've heard about. Oh yeah, this. You know, this group of people figured out a way to revitalize these pens or to create new pens based on other pens that they chop off and stick in the same sort of form factor.
Re-inking them or something. They're going to have dried out or whatever.
Yeah, that is the problem is all the pens are dried out. So you have to get pens that work. And I still don't know if that's a thing, if there's a reliable source for the pens. But if there was, I would buy this in a heartbeat.
As Curtis says in the chat, it produced surprisingly readable 80 columns on very narrow paper. It did, absolutely. Like it would write them out just perfectly. Like it was really sharp and lovely. But the problem was it was this little strip of paper. Like you could oh my gosh, I printed so many little charts and so many, you know, basic printouts on this though. It's just flooding back the memories of this terrible, terrible printer that I now want to have so badly.
So if anybody listening to this podcast knows of where you can get a reliable source of new pens for these kind of things, and I don't care if it's the Radio Shack one or the Atari one or the Commodore one, I have a computer that can plug into any of them. I just want one that works and one that you can get the pens for. And our address is feedback@rcrpodcast.com. Please let us know, because I want to have one of these. It's just watching them work is so fun, too.
Curtis in the chat says, you print it as 2 columns and Xerox them together on an 8.5 by 11 page, and so your essay is now just a 2-column thing like a magazine. I was not nearly that creative.
That's kind of genius.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, great choice. My goodness. I just love looking at this.
Yeah, but so, I mean, do plotters exist now?
Sure.
I don't know if, like, is there a modern plotter?
Yeah, Oh, that's the, but they're large. Large for like 3 and 4 foot wide paper. We have a plotter. I've got a plotter at work, just like in the office next to mine, where we print large blueprints and landscape drawings on giant plotters.
Okay. So what kind of pens do they use? No, I guess that was the idea. Like,
yeah, it's like a big inkjet thing.
Oh, I see. Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I have, I forget what it's called. I guess maybe it's the Apple plotter. This big, it looks like an image writer, but it's in fact a plotter, that I've been meaning to like try out. You know, I think it's pretty cool, but, the pens, you know, I don't know if any of them work, you know, they probably don't.
They could scratch in though. And you're just like,
yeah.
So it occurs to me though, instead. That printer we have at work is essentially the closest thing I have to an old fashioned tractor feed printer, because it takes a huge spool of printer of paper. So it's like a 50 foot line of paper, and it just plots it out and tears it off at like, I think it's 4 foot wide paper. So we can do 4x3 giant printouts. Mm-hmm. If I was malicious, which I might be, I could hook something up to play a recording of an Image Writer 2 whenever it printed, and it would be like a giant dot. And nobody in the office would figure out why or what was happening. And it might bring me great joy. So that might be a thing I want to do. That'd be hilarious. Whenever it moves, just start playing the sound of an Image Writer. Giant cross.
So. Excellent. I forget. There was an early video that I'm only remembering the pieces of this sort of halfway, but so Cable Sasser, who is the guy, one of the Panic guys, had, you know, somewhere early on, there was a new, you know, Apple released some new Mac or whatever, and he was in correspondence with somebody who was really kind of agitated about the noise that the fans were making in these new ones. And so he made this little video, and you know, I think I've seen it somewhat recently, where you know, I was noticing how old it was. It was like little and not many pixels across or down. but anyway, like he made this little video where he, you know, had got the new machine and he reached over and turned it on, and the fans ramped up and it made this huge noise. And then after a second, you know, the idea is he sent this to the person who was all agitated about the noise and, you know, caused great anxiety and rage. But you know, soon the camera pans around and he's like vacuuming at the same time. You know, it's like very nice, very nicely done.
Joel in the chat asks if you have a hard copy printout of this podcast episode. I say yes. It's also available on vinyl or cassette tape.
Yeah. Oh, I should say, so we talked, I think, a couple episodes ago about the A2 Stream, which is it's like a streaming audio for the Apple II.
Yes.
So we've put the last couple of episodes, I think it was 255 and 256, were made available with the A2 Stream source. So if you have an A2 Stream setup, you can listen to those two.
You can stop now and go back like and re-listen.
That's right. But yeah, so this one, I'll keep doing that for a while at least. So if you want to listen to RCR on your Apple II GS or whatever, you can. And I think actually it is now possible to do it relatively easy through emulation too. Cool. I think Apple Win can emulate the Ethernet 2 card that you need to do that. So, but it sounds better on an actual machine. Anyway, yeah, I got sidetracked. Somewhere I'll find that video though with the vacuum cleaner. I've spoiled it, but it was still funny. Okay. I actually didn't find as many things as I usually do, which is probably okay. I found this, which like I found it. I thought, oh, that's interesting. It'd be worth talking about this, and between, you know, in like 20 minutes later, it was sold. I think we have talked about these before.
Unobtainium. They just.
Yep. We should mention what it is, though.
Yeah, no. That's good enough. it's an IBM 5160 PC expansion unit. And it looks like an IBM PC or PC XT. It from the outside, it just looks like that's all it is.
Yeah, if I walked into some room or an auction or whatever and saw this, I would assume it's an IBM PC. That's just what it looks like.
It turns out that it's a PC-shaped box that you sit next to your actual PC and fill it with all the cards that you couldn't fit in your actual PC.
You have a strong desk to hold them both up there.
Yeah. So it's basically just a bunch of slots. I think also a spot for a hard drive and a power supply. And the way it works is you put a card in each of them to, you know, in your PC to communicate with the expansion box and then and back. So I've never seen one in real life. I can imagine what one looks like because it looks just like a PC. But at the same time, it's interestingly rare. So the earliest, were you actually looking for one at some point or?
No, I've just heard people talking about it and people who are in the market for it. And yeah, they're quite rare.
Yeah. Someone pulled the trigger on this one for $1,000.
Yeah. Or maybe something slightly less, but I mean, surely it was somewhere in the ballpark. It was listed for as a buy it now for $1,000, and it was gone. I mean, I saw it, you know, I saw it in the morning. It was gone by the afternoon.
Yeah. So the person wouldn't have accepted an offer for $500 that quickly. So yeah, it went for a bunch.
Yeah. Anyway, interesting thing to know it exists if you're looking for it.
Too late.
You can. It's possible that if you came across somebody who didn't know what they had and they just were selling IBM personal computer expansion unit, or even better, IBM 5161 with no further indication, you might sneak in there and get it when no one noticed it. But 5150 is the PC, 5160 right. is the XT, and then 5161 is the XT expansion.
Yes.
So. Okay. Here we go. I found this funny. It's what it is it's an Apple mouse pad. I had this
mouse pad.
Yeah, I have at least one of them. It came with my SE30. I think, you know, my original one when I bought it. I mean, like, I think it was just like it was a thing that they threw in. You know, I never
but
seemed
you
like
fancy
a collectible
people who
to
had
me.
SE30s.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
said
I think to every. But they probably gave it to with the
us
SE
lesser
as well.
People too.
Yeah.
They gave it to us SE owners. Yeah.
What I thought was kind of funny was just the picture of this mouse pad on an little easel.
Right. I can looking at it though. I remember the feeling of the mouse pad, like the hard part on the top and the sponginess below. Like looking at it, I can the tactile feeling of the plastic top and the spongy bottom. I find it weird that like you point out, or I guess either your notes right here. Oh, the Garamond. It's the Apple Garamond logo. So I find it weirdly spaced. It's odd that it's not centered vertically, that it's on the top half of the mouse pad, so it's got a bunch of white space on the bottom. That was an odd choice.
Yeah.
Maybe it ends up looking better because of that. I don't know. So imagine if it was in the middle. But it's odd that Apple said, yeah, we're going to just like not have this centered.
Maybe the mouse was most often in the lower half.
Ah.
So you could read it better if, you know, like the mouse wouldn't be covering it, your wrist wouldn't be covering it. And
you think you'd make it much smaller and in the corner or something. But I think I had this exact mouse pad.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it was nice as mouse pads go, I guess. I sort of use my mice without pads now, which
I thought everyone did. 2 weeks ago, I had somebody at work ask me if they can have a new mouse pad. And I'm like, what do you mean you have a new mouse pad? And they're using a mouse pad. I'm like, how and why and where are you? Did you get that mouse pad? I set up your computer and I did not set it up with a mouse. So they brought their own and laid it on the table and I just didn't even notice. And I'm like, you don't need to use it. Because, oh yeah, I need to use my mouse on the pad. I'm like, I have great news for you. That's 30 years late in coming, but you don't need to use that anymore.
No, but I like even on these, my machines of the era, I tended to just like use the mouse on the desk, and it's terrible. Like, there was a reason we had mouse pads. Yep.
Especially with the rolling ball ones.
Yeah.
But with a good modern laser based one.
Yeah. Anyway, so it's a nice mouse pad and it's a funny presentation. Okay, let's see. Is this still okay? This hasn't been bought yet. next thing I have is a Timex Sinclair's 2068, which is like the U.S. or North American Spectrum. And it's actually, it seems like it's not bad. It's $150 buy it now. It comes in its box. The box, I think, has some tape on the back, but otherwise it all looks pretty good. So if you were looking for something like this, it seems like it's a fairly good instance of it. It may not have the power supply. Actually, I think now that I am looking at this, it does not have the power supply. So you'd have to probably get one of those, you know, like multi-voltage switcher things and just pick whichever one goes with it. Anyway, it looks nice, and I think we've talked about them before. They're a little bit uncommon. I have one right here.
Enough that Paul only has three.
It's one of these things that I really kind of want to play around with. We talked about it, I think, you know, 8 episodes ago or something, but I got a little, I think it's called a twister or something like that, that allows you to plug in sort of solid state solution for the Spectrum into this, because the pins on the expansion thing aren't quite exactly the same, but it also provides like HDMI out, and so I'm all set if I can just find the time to play with it.
But, play with that amazing keyboard.
Yeah, and the great colors, the Spectrum colors. But yeah, the keyboard
The Spectrum
insane.
Colors, I have mocked them for years, but secretly in my heart, I kind of like them.
Yeah.
Like there's something about the cyans and the magentas. What? You just gasped. What did you see?
I see a very worn keyboard.
A very worn keyboard. Somebody's typed on this thing like crazy.
Yeah.
Also weirdly worn above.
Yeah. I wonder what's up with that?
Looks like somebody photoshopped it badly.
Well, fat picked, you know, like fat fingers.
But in between.
So they typed a lot of A, S, and D, and F. Maybe that's actually where
they
were touch typing. Yeah. They were resting on the home key for a long time.
odd though.
Yeah, yeah. I'm less impressed now that I've seen how worn the keyboard is. Learning how to type on one of these is a challenge. I mean, I think it's the same challenge that the Spectrum people had.
Right.
But there's like multiple modifiers to try to get at, you know, like all the 5 different things that each key can do. So. But that's part of the fun too, I guess.
Yeah.
One thing I observed is that even if the keys are kind of worn, it does say that all ports are clean and erosion free, which I thought was kind of funny. And I thought, they meant corrosion. What a funny error. But actually, the keys are not erosion free.
Right.
So, okay. And then the last one is the
what is this?
1985. Yeah, it's a combination trackball keypad for the like first era of Macintosh.
Is it for Mac? How does it plug in?
It's got one of the little things that go in the back of a.
But I thought the first
Mac 128K.
Didn't they use like a phone port for the keyboard?
The later ones did.
Oh really? The later ones. I thought the very first one did. Oh, I got it backwards. Okay.
Well, so I think I might be wrong. This might go into the mouse spot, actually. I think that's the mouse. It's the mouse.
Oh,
plug.
Which makes sense. Being a trackpad.
The phone thing may have been. Though, do not use a phone cord for your Mac keyboard because the power, you know, power ground relationship is wrong, and you will hurt something. It was a dumb idea. You have to use a Mac keyboard cable to connect your Mac keyboard to your Mac. If you use a phone cord, you will fry something.
Excellent. Oh, I see. In later pictures, it shows the back of this. It shows like the phone cord. They are the RJ22 jacks for keyboard and computer. Mm-hmm. So, okay.
Yeah.
This is cool. I have not seen this. So it's both a trackpad and a little numeric keypad, which, you know, people often, if you're right-handed, want both of those off to the right. So cool. Mm-hmm. Neat. 2 buttons, though. That's a lot of buttons for an early Mac.
Yeah, it's right. It's got 2 buttons and it's got these 2
non-buttons
on the
top that are.
I don't know what those are.
I think they're pretend wheels.
Yeah, they don't look like they actually function for anything. They're just sort of raised semicircles. Like they might be. I mean, like you know, if you were trying to use it in the dark.
I can see there being gears in there though, or gears that show you like because 2 different wheels, kind of make a trackpad. So. Oh, it's weird.
Oh, you mean that? So it's like sort of physically
right.
Dodging something that's inside. It could be.
Oh.
I was thinking maybe it could also be for. I was thinking it could like be a guide for like if you were trying to put like a piece of paper in there or something. But why would you do that?
I don't know.
Anyway, it's interesting. So I knew something. A simulation process.
You know that? I don't know them.
Yeah, they made a number of these early Mac input devices, and somebody Apple related was also related to. So it might have been, was it Randy Wigginton maybe? Somebody was part of the assimilation process team post being part of the Apple team. And it was somebody who was at a Kansas Fest sometime, you know, several years ago. Because I remember trying to find like an assimilation process trackball to bring with me to get it signed. Oh. But now I've forgotten who it was that I was going to have it signed by. So
I have just found, I'll stick a link in here for you to look at, this link I'll share, an old Flickr post from 2016 showing a different model of this, that it, by assimilation process, but it's just the trackball without the keypad. Very different coloring, though. So I don't know if this is yellowed, but the earliest Macs were this color you've got.
Yeah.
Whereas here's a thing which, like, much lighter, with almost blue buttons, and it says it's for the Mac 512 KE. So, okay. But it's got those same little bumps, though. That's what really why I was looking at. It's got those same one horizontal, one vertical kind of wheels sticking up through it, bumps, for whatever reason.
Yeah.
It says this one's for the 2E and 2C as well. So maybe that's why.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, it's interesting because I had not come across the company assimilation process before sort of like doing the research into the person who was going to be keynote at Kansas Fest, you know, 5 years ago or whatever it was. And, you know, it turns out they made a bunch of these things. So, and I think they were well regarded too.
Yeah. I had a, for an old Mac, I don't remember which Mac it was, but maybe the Quadri or whatever. I had a Silhouette trackball, and that was the only time I used the trackball as my main thing. And I loved it. So I don't remember who even made it, but it was a thing called a Silhouette trackball. It was one of those ones where it had a replaceable ball, so you could buy like fun ones. You could buy ones that looked like an eyeball or an eight ball or whatever. So I had that, and I loved it. And then I went back to mice. It's like, that was great. Okay, I'm done with you now.
Yeah, it seems like a really, you know, convenient kind of input device. I had a Kensington that I used on the Windows systems, and man, that thing was awesome.
The Kensington ones were weird because I think they used to call them a turbo mouse. Yeah. I was like, why do you call it a turbo mouse when it's clearly not a mouse?
Well, that's true. Although, talk about the turbo, though, you could really get that mouse cursor moving with one of the trackballs. So if you were doing any kind of workflow where you wanted to jet your mouse cursor around the screen like at warp speed, but then also have the fine control when you were trying to zero in on something, a trackball was the thing. It was really nice. I did quite a bit of desktop publishing for our team, and so I'd have to be moving things around and jumping around between windows, and the trackball was great for that.
And I'm still kind of distracted trying to figure out who worked for this company, but I'll figure it out at some point. It's actually not very well described. I can find ads for these in like old InfoWorlds or something, but I am yet to find a description of the company. Actually, I could just go to Wikipedia and look up assimilation process, probably. Assimilation process. What happens? It probably is the name of some actual process. So
by the Borg.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Strange New Worlds is weird. By the way, it's new Star Trek, and it's really quite a lot. Like what I think I remember of the original series, like in its just bizarre premises.
Yeah, I think that's on purpose. Boy, yeah. I really like that series. I have to admit, I'm like a super fan of Strange New Worlds. I've seen all the new Trek, and Strange New Worlds is by far my favorite.
But it's definitely a different flavor. It's
totally different. It's episodic, first off. It's not like one continuous story.
I would like that.
Yes, I prefer the episodic series as well. It is definitely flavored, you know, the humor, the visuals, everything like that just makes you feel like you're watching the original series.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess we've made it through eBay. That's all I had. That's as weird as it gets this time. So I guess we can go to closing discussions. And Carrington, you have the first thing here.
Do I? What have I got? I've got...
In Search of Darkness.
Oh, yes. I got it. for retro fans, I love old. Speaking of, I guess, things on VHS, these are Blu-rays. I picked up a thing called In Search of Tomorrow, which is a Blu-ray, the definitive 80s science fiction documentary. 300 minutes of sci-fi gold, which I'm very much looking forward to watching. And I don't remember asking for it, but I guess I did. It also came with In Search of Darkness and In Search of Darkness 2, which are the same things for 80s horror movies. And also came with a poster and a postcard for In Search of Darkness 3. So I guess I'll be getting that too, even though I haven't watched any of these things. But they look amazing. So if you're into 1980s era movies, 80s sci-fi in particular for the In Search of Tomorrow, or 80s horror, so VHS era stuff, they look like deeply cool documentaries with a ton of people from the era, directors and stars and background people and effects people or whatever, talking about like how things are made. Like here's a bit of an interview with Bruce Boxleitner talking about like doing the light cycle stuff in Tron and running around with a broom because of it and stuff or whatever. Like, it just like looks amazing. So haven't watched them and yet highly recommend. So we'll see. I'm very excited. I'll be watching that after this show. That's what I got. That's retro. That's retro oriented.
Yeah, I like it. Earl, any closing thoughts?
I have no parting shots this time, so it's just good to retro yak with you guys as always.
Sounds kind of throwing up, but okay, yes.
Yeah, I was going to say exactly. That's how I remember referring to that in high school, and I'm not sure that's what I would hope to do. But anyway.
We used it for talking when I was growing up.
Oh, talking.
I have to admit. I'm not sure which definition is more applicable for what we do, but
let's see. I have one thing that's happened to me recently was I did a fair amount of traveling to small groups of family. So I have not done much traveling in the last couple of years, and so this involved driving to Montreal and driving to Minnesota from the East Coast. And it's been sort of interesting. I haven't driven that much for a long time, but one thing that's meant is I have not been editing. So even though the last episode was recorded almost a month ago, that's still yet to hit the feed. But I think these two, I'm back now, so I think these two will go. I've been spending some time working on. I some months ago claimed to Kansas Fest that I would present about writing an arcade game for the Apple III. And I'm now doing that since I have to talk about it in a couple weeks. But it's going pretty well. It's pretty fun. The idea is essentially that the Apple III has some sort of like technical stuff in it that makes it pretty good for games, even though it didn't last long enough for anyone to write any. So
yeah, the only Apple III games I ever see or mention is when you're looking at an Apple II game, and it'll say in the documents, if you're playing this on an Apple III, you got to go into Apple II mode. Like,
yeah,
that's it.
Yeah, the Apple III could it could emulate a 48K Apple II, and so anything except black and white. So you only get to play your Apple II games, if they run in 48K, and if you don't mind them being in black and white, even though the computer otherwise could do color. So anyway, so I've been playing around with like that, just trying to basically write a game that uses all the stuff that it can do. And it's been a challenge because, part of the reason that nobody wrote anything for it is because the documentation, it didn't exist before, and it's pretty scarce even now. I mean, like, it kind of says that it can do this thing, but not exactly how it can do that thing. So, so I've learned a fair amount of stuff along the way, which at least I can contribute to the documenting.
I was going to say, more than even the game or whatever, if you make it, creating the documentation, like helping other people know, hey, here's a thing, is probably the big step you could contribute. That's cool.
Yeah. So I don't know if you remember the way the Apple II graphics works, but it's
memory holes and stuff.
It's pretty ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, so in order to save, chip logic and that, chip space and whatever, the high resolution graphics is sort of an alternating, and text also is an alternating lines. It's sort of like three screen regions. So if you increase the address, you'll draw things on one line, and then you'll wind up, the next thing you'll do is like a third of the screen down, and then another third of the screen down. So they interleave everything. And in 80 column mode on the Apple II, they did the same kind of thing where they had 40 columns of text and they wanted to get 80. So what they did was they took like the even characters from one page and the odd characters from another page and then smushed them together. So if you want to actually write 80 column text, you have to write alternating letters in different parts of this memory. And the Apple III does all of that, like, you know, two more levels. So everything is interleaved. The highest color, high resolution graphics mode has every 7 pixels are stored in 4 bytes. So and they're alternating. So you have like 2 bytes on page 1 and 2 bytes on page 2, but they don't line up across, you know, like, so like the first pixel is all in the first byte. That's actually fairly straightforward, and that's the last straightforward pixel.
Hope you enjoyed it. That's the last time it'll be straightforward.
The next pixel is like 3 bits of that byte, and then 1 bit from a different byte 2,000 bytes away.
Well, the one thing you learned, if you're doing Apple graphics at all, it's always done with tables. You simply go,
yeah.
Instead, I'm going to use this table, and it just tells me where everything goes, pre-calculated, because it's crazy.
Anyway, it's been fun, though. I mean, like, you know, that I've learned a fair amount. I'm looking forward to, like, putting this together. I'm kind of looking forward to the game working, but, I mean, that's, at this point, not even that important. But it's kind of fun. I can see it maybe being interesting. So,
cool.
All right. Anyway, that's what I've been doing. Okay, I guess that's it. We made it.
I want to dance.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Got to get to the dancing part. So that's it for this show. We have reached the part where Carrington dances. You can find the notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com, particularly if you know something about how to get new pens for the old plotter printers. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com, and please write a review on iTunes if you wish. And until next time,
Retro Compute. Myself back to